last week, we won't necessarily go pasuk by pasuk, but we'll talk about just the Aliyah as a whole. The Aliyah has a theme, the Mizbach HaKetores, the Mizbach for the incense, for the Ketores. And here, there is a little bit that we can discuss in a general sense. First, you should mention that there is a question that all the Rishonim and Achronim talk about. This is a very popular issue with many different answers. And it has to do with placement. Why is this here? So in Parshas Truma, we talked about the construction of the Mishkan. And now with Tetzaveh, so we talk about the Begadim and related things. So all of a sudden, at the end of Tetzaveh, to come and start talking about what would seem to really belong in Parshas Truma is a question. It's a question everyone talks about. And a little synergy, maybe we'll bring it up again, is that last week, if you recall, over our Skype conversation, we spoke about what was included in Parshas Truma and what Soloveitchik understood as the message there. So maybe we'll reiterate that here. But in any event, this question of what is the Ketores doing here at the end of Tetzaveh rather than in Truma is a question that everyone talks about. So among those who talk about it is the Ramban. Now the Ramban says that this is to show that there's something unusual about the Ketores, that it is a sod, that there are elements that we don't understand. It has the ability to hold back the plague, and it has a great mystical qualities to it, and therefore it's separated from the other aspects of the Beis HaMikdash in order to make that point. And Rabbeinu Bachya, commenting on this Ramban, he writes that this is a refutation of the Rambam, that the Rambam wrote in Mor Nevuchim that the purpose of the Ketores is to create a positive smell to offset the less than wonderful smell of the animals that are being cut up and cleaned over there. So in order to counteract that, so you have the Ketores, and the Rabbeinu Bachya was very unhappy with that. He said that's definitely not a lofty enough reason for something of this level. So he says, especially here, the Ramban telling us that there is a sod here, that there is something above and beyond, and very deep, that's something he was much more comfortable with. But nonetheless, you have interpretations that seem to go in both directions, interpretations that are there to emphasize something about this that is perhaps less than the rest, and something about this that is perhaps more than the rest. So for example, in many of the Mefarshim, such as the Meshech Chachma, the Maril Diskin, and others, they note that this is to show that this isn't the Ikuva, that this does not hold back even the bringing of the Ketores. Even without this Mizbech, it could bring the Ketores. So unlike the rest of what we talk about, this doesn't have a unavoidable role. In a similar vein, the Aznayim Latara notes that if we were to have mentioned this in Truma together with the Mizbech Ola, the Mizbech where the Korbanos are brought, so then it would put a bad light, so to speak, on that Mizbech. That Mizbech would look less chashuv by comparison, because this Mizbech is gold and is more bifnim, and therefore it has to be placed in a different section, because otherwise it will create a bad impression, a bad light on the other Mizbech. But in any event, the Menchas Aram, contemporary Sefer on Chumash, so he suggests that, and others have ideas similar to this as well, that it's not in Parshas Truma because it's not really a part of the construction of the Mikdash. It's not really a part of the Mishkan. And he says that that's not going to work for the Ramban. The reason the Ramban has to give the other approach that we just mentioned about there being a sod here is because this answer wouldn't be enough for him, because we discussed a little bit last week, there is a machlokas in general between the Rambam and the Ramban as to the role of the Kalim. So according to the Rambam, the Kalim are all part of the mitzvah of Binyan Beis HaMikdash, because everything that's necessary or that's helpful for the karbanos is all one big mitzvah. But according to Ramban, the kelim are a separate mitzvah. So this approach to say that this is put here in the end of Kitzaveh because it's not a part of the Mikdash, so then that works specifically for the Rambam who organized things that way, that everything that's a part of that mitzvah will be in Parshas Truma. Although it's a little difficult from the Rambam himself otherwise, because the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos does sound like this is part of the Mikdash, but okay, at least in theory, and Menachas Aaron notes that himself, but in theory, this could be an approach that only that which is really a part of the Mikdash itself, which according to Rambam's understanding includes these kelim, so that's mentioned in Truma, and this is separate from that. It says the Ramban has to give his other answer because he's not working off the same approach. However, you could say that even within the Ramban, I think, that, so according to the Ramban, the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash, the purpose of the mitzvah to make a Beis HaMikdash, if it's not about the Korbanos specifically, so what is it about? So it's about, as he explains in his commentary to Chumash over there, the Asuli Mikdash, the Shachanti B'Sochav, it's about creating a home for the Shechina. So here, that could also be a distinction, because the Sfarno, for example, writes over here that this is not about bringing in the Shechina, this is about something that's done to honor HaKadosh Baruch Hu now that he's here, and once the Shechina is present, but this is not about creating the environment necessarily for the Shechina. So therefore, even according to the Ramban, one could theoretically see this as something that needs to be distinct from that which is in Truma. And in that context, that's what we mentioned last week from Soloveitchik, who suggested that that which is mentioned in Truma, the Shulchan and the Aron and the Menorah, he had an imagery for all of those that was consistent just with the conception of a bias based on what the Isha Ashuramis describes as necessary for creating a hospitality suite in her house. So therefore the idea of the Shechina being housed in the Mishkan, so that again is what is in that parsha. And here, this is something that is distinct from that. Some point out also that the Ketores doesn't constitute its own korban; it's something that's there to be machshir other korbanos. The Sefer Shir Chumash has a whole discussion about this. There is an interesting comment in a Sefer called Otzer Panine HaTorah, where he notes that we have an idea that the Ketores is a skula. So if it talked about as a skula itself, or read the Parshas HaKetores is a skula itself, if you want to read more about that, you can read at length from the Sefer Otzer Plos HaTorah, which is a different Sefer than the Otzer Pnine HaTorah. But in the Otzer Pnine HaTorah, he makes the point, which is an important reminder from time to time, that to whatever extent the skula is helpful, the skula is meaningful, it has to be on top of everything else, not instead of everything else. So first we need the actual ikarim of the Mishkan, and we need all the details of what happens. And then after that we can talk about skulas, but the mentality that a skula has a place that can take the place of the actual bread and butter, of the actual mitzvahs themselves, of the actual ikarim, so that's a mistake, and he suggests that that's why the placement is here at the very end, in order to emphasize that. Okay, interesting idea. The Sefer Yunin B'Parsha of Avram Heschel Reisman, so he makes the point that he thinks the need to display the Shechina is now at the end of this whole process, and the menorah together with the Ketores, they do that. And he explains that we basically have three processes in the world. We have that which is natural, Apidarach HaTava, that's the one way HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. Then we have the Nisim Guyim, we have miracles that are explicit miracles. And in a sense, the highest level are the Nisim that are then directed within Tava. So the Gemara says that the purpose of the menorah, which burned miraculously, was to tell Kol Bo'ei Olam, was to advertise to the whole world, Shah Shechina Shara B'Yisrael. So on the one hand, the menorah represents something miraculous, but the Torah takes it to a different level, because the menorah represents light, which is completely without any chomer to it, without any actual material, while smell is the combination, as you find this in other Svarim also, that smell is, you know, the combination of Gashmius and Ruchni. It's a very transcendent idea. So therefore, that does even the most to represent the miracles of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, that's going to close this whole theme, and therefore it's the end of Truma and Tetzaveh. But Sefer Achinuch writes about this concept, about the Ketores, that the purpose of the Ketores is to increase the honor of the Mishkan, of the Beis HaMikdash. And he writes, because people can only relate to that, can only see chashivas through that which they can appreciate, that which they can enjoy. So the positive aroma has that purpose to it. But there is another idea as well. Rav Nevensal Shlita has a whole essay about this in his Sichos, where he suggests that there's another point here, that we find that Ketores, so what does the language of Ketores mean? What does the word mean? So it comes, we usually understand it comes from to create a smoke, to create some kind of a physical result like that. But he notes from the Zohar, the language of Kitur, Kesher, is to create a bond between us and God. And the purpose of the Ketores is essentially to bond us more to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he goes on to discuss how that is particularly necessary in the sense that we have to fix something that is broken. And there is a distance that's created, so we need the Ketores to bridge that gap. And we find that the Gemara in Maseches Erechin mentions the Ketores as one of a few things that brings about atonement for Lashon Hara. And here it refers to something that's done here of the Pnimiyah, something that's done in quiet, and refers to the damage that's done in private. The public damage, as it goes on to explain, the public damage, the distance that Lashon Hara creates between people. So that's where Tzaras comes in. The fact that the person who speaks Lashon Hara ends up quarantined. So that's to fix the fact, to address the fact that he caused a separation between people with his speech. But what about the fact that it creates a separation between you and God? So that's where the Ketores is coming to address the breach between man and God. So he discusses there, and he goes on to a couple of different levels of this, of different chatoi halashon. It's a very worthwhile essay. But he touches upon a point, he doesn't get into this so much, but he says that why is this specifically considered to be a breach between man and God? So we know it's an aveira. Okay, so every aveira creates a separation between man and God. But then let's have this be mechaper for everything in that sense. Why specifically Lashon Hara as creating a break, not only between man and man, that we understand very well, but particularly creating a separation between the speaker and God. So what he focuses on there is actually a controversial point. He doesn't get into the whole controversy, but he just mentions really a Gemara, which creates this impression. He says that normally a person does an Aveira, it's because he wants to do the Aveira. It's because the Aveira is appealing. It's because, say, he wants to steal money because he wants money, or he wants to eat non-kosher food because the non-kosher food is tempting. Okay, so then we understand. But here, the only motive in speaking Lashon Hara is to attack God, is to anger God, because he doesn't have any personal hanas. So I see eyebrows being raised at that. And indeed, again, he doesn't go into this, but this was a controversial point. And it was a surprisingly controversial point, because you would not think that this is the kind of thing, especially in a yeshiva context where we're used to sichos musar, you wouldn't necessarily see this as such a controversial point. But it was a major machlokas between the Chafetz Chaim and the Chazon Ish. That The Chafetz Chaim, when he lists Averos in the beginning of his Sefer, he lists all the different things you could do wrong when you speak Lashon Hara. So some of them are pretty straightforward, and some are more creative. Right? If you speak Lashon Hara about your parents in a shul on Shabbos, then you're in violation also of Kibud Av Va'Em and Maror HaMikdash and Maror Shabbos, etc. So some of them are a little more creative. But one that he mentions there is that's Achil Hashem. So you wouldn't think that that's so controversial. Again, we're used to Sichos Musa, where we find the term Achil Hashem used often. It's not something which normally needs much of a justification. But Chazon Ish argued on him. Chazon Ish said, no, it's not Achil Hashem. Why was this a debatable point? Because the Chofetz Chaim was discussing this same point that Rav Zal makes here. And again, it sounds like it from the Gemara in Tainus that this seems like the Gemara is saying this, that Lashon Hara is different from other Averos in that there's no personal Hana. It's not something you do because you're pursuing something you would want. It's just something you do to anger God. It's just something you do to be terrible. So the Chazon Ish commented on that. He says, if the Chafetz Chaim really thinks that there's no Hana in Lashon Hara, says this is proof that the holy author never tasted Lashon Hara in his life. He must not know what exactly is really the temptation people have for Lashon Hara. So he took issue with this. He said it's not a chalasha. So okay, there's what to explain about the Chafetz Chaim's position about this, but this point that Rav David Sal alludes to is actually a controversial point. It happens to be that the Chafetz Chaim also, in the bottom part, in the Ber Mayim Chaim, so he gives two other reasons why he thinks Lashon Hara is specifically Achil Hashem more than other Averos. He mentions that he thinks that Achil Hashem is an Avera which builds upon itself and gets bigger and bigger. And he says that's also typical when it comes to Lashon Hara, that you very often see that if you try to stop someone from speaking Lashon Hara, so their reaction often is to double down, is often to say, oh, you think I shouldn't be saying this, let me tell you why I have to say this, why it's so important, he's such a terrible person. So it's an Avera that kind of like the Tzfardeya keeps growing the more you hit it. So that's another reason to call it Achil Hashem. And on top of that, he also notes that Achil Hashem is another definition of it, is an Avera that is very chomer, is very serious, but people take it lightly. People are frivolous towards it. So from that definition, you could say, okay, then Lashon Hara is the best example of Achil Hashem. It's a serious Avera that people are very lax towards. So that's definitely the case there. So if that's your definition of Achil Hashem, then yes. So in any event, I mean, you could say that that's what creates this interruption, that this Achil Hashem. But there's probably also another idea as well, and this is something that Rav Eventzal alludes to a little bit in the Sicha, but there's maybe more to say about it, that the notion of Lashon Hara is rooted in an attitude, it's rooted in a certain perspective and a way of seeing things, and it doesn't stop there. So this is something that the Rambam mentions in Hilchos Tumas Tzaras, in Mishnah Torah he talks about this, says that the idea of Lashon Hara is that first a person talks about his friends with a negative attitude, and that's really the Iker Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is not just about relating factual things, which is what I think is a little bit of a mistaken perspective, that people think that the main Isser of Lashon Hara is saying such and such happened. And if you know that it happened, then I'm allowed to discuss what I think about it. But really, I think it's the other way around, that the main issue with Lashon Hara is you're editorializing about it and saying what you think about what happened. So that doesn't become less so just because everyone you're talking to knows about the episode. It's the very fact that you're putting a negative spin on it that is really where the Avera is primarily located. So that is a reflection of a certain attitude about things, a certain way of thinking about things. And the Rambam writes in Tumas Taras, it doesn't stop there, that somebody who's going to talk like that about his friends ultimately he's going to talk like that about the rabbis, and ultimately he's going to talk like that about a Kadosh Baruch Hu also, and he's not going to be able to appreciate a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So this kind of an attitude puts a dividing line between people and God. You're not going to be able to appreciate the Ribbono Shel Olam if you come from this perspective of negativity. And perhaps in that way we can connect this to Parsha Zohar, which we'll say more about in a moment. But just the theme of Amalek, so there is a notion that Amalek is compared in Chazal, based on a pasuk in Mishle, Chazal compare Amalek to a letz. And that provokes the question, a letz in our modern language, we use that to mean a clown, and it's very unusual imagery for Amalek. We wouldn't picture Amalek as a clown if we're going to cast the Amalek movie. We want him to be immediately recognizable. We probably wouldn't have the actor go up there in big floppy shoes and a big red nose and an orange wig. That wouldn't be the picture you'd have of a Amalek. So this is something that Rav Huttner discusses in a very important sikha, which I would say is a major marmakum for everybody. Everyone should read the sikha in the Pachid Yitzchak, the first Pachid Yitzchak in Purim. We mentioned it before?
Yes.
Yeah, it could be recently? Okay, so I'll mention it again. Again, it's an important piece to read. That this first Maimer and Purim, so Rav Huttner explains that a letz is somebody who is a cynic, is somebody who doesn't think anything's important. And that's what a Amalek was. A Amalek knocked down the importance of the Jewish people. They said, oh, they're not so significant, they're not so intimidating. That here, following the episode of the Kriyas Yamsuf, so the world took the Jews seriously, they thought they were intimidating, and Amalek wanted to make the point that no, they're not so scary, they're not so significant, and we can attack them, you can too. Chazal used that imagery of a burning bath, people are a boiling bath, people are afraid to jump in, and here they make the first attack, and the rest of the world sees not such a big deal. So, in any event, there this does seem to connect the two, this idea of the Parsha and Zohar, that this attitude of cynicism essentially is saying that nothing is important, nothing can get through to me because nothing really matters, and that's going to certainly affect your relationship with the Torah and your relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So Lashon Hara is an attack against other people, but it doesn't stop there. It's not going to be the end of it. It's going to keep going. It reflects a certain attitude, and therefore it certainly is something that beyond other averos distances you from God, and that's something that we have to take very seriously. That's something that has to be appreciated. So we'll come back and say a little bit more about Zohar in a second, but just before we leave the Parsha, just to say one more point about the Parsha. So Moshe Feinstein and Sefer Darash Moshe has an interesting ha'ara where he notes that also we see here in the Psukim, so the placing together of the Ketores and the lighting of the menorah. So he has an interesting drasha on that point. He says, why are they two linked? So he suggests that the lighting of the menorah represents Torah, represents the Talmidei Chachamim. He says the Talmidei Chachamim have to have a sense of smell. They have to have the ability to be able to perceive when something is wrong, even if it's not overt, even if it's not something you can necessarily point to and say this detail is incorrect, but when there's something that's not following the whole spirit of the concept, they have to be able to perceive that. So he says, therefore, there's this connection between the hadlaka and the ketoros, that there has to be the Torah together with a sense of smell. It's a necessary trait for a Talmud Chacham. It's a very important idea. Okay, so now let's say a little bit more about Zohar. So Zohar is an interesting concept. We know that there is a mitzvah min haTorah of Zichiras Amalek. That is clear and explicit in the end of Parshas Kiseitse. Torah says, Zohar es asher asa lecha Amalek, and also says, L'sishkach. So we know that that is a biblical obligation. The question is, how does that develop into what we have on our shul announcements this week, and we tell people to make sure that even if you don't come to shul any other time of the year, that you should make sure to come to shul the Shabbos, because it's the one time that it's a mitzvah d'oraisa, to hear Kriyas HaTorah. Normally Kriyas HaTorah is Din Drabanan. Here Kriyas HaTorah is Daraisa because of Zachar Asher Asal L'cha Malik. So is that assumption 100% inarguable? So that we have to see. So first of all, is it actually the only time? Let's say we accept that it is the case, but is it the only time? That's also what to talk about, and we'll revisit this for Parshas Parah, because there's a view in Rishon and Parshas Parah may also be Doraisa. But let's leave that question aside, whether it's the only time or not. But is there a Chiyuv Ben HaTorah to hear the laning in Shul the Shabbos? So there's a couple of questions that we have to figure out. So yes, the Torah says, remember Amalek. But how do we know that remembering Amalek requires a Sefer Torah and a minyan and a timing of the Shabbos? Maybe it could be a different time. So, although maybe it doesn't have to be every year. Maybe it could be once. So to put all those parts together and say, not only is Zichiras Amalek a mitzvah min HaTorah, but specifically from a Sefer Torah with a minyan every year and on this Shabbos. So that is a bigger package. We have to figure out where those parts come from. Hi.
Practically, can you answer the question by just saying, you should read where it talks about Amalek in the Torah? That's a great way to remember it. Not saying it's a fate. Let's just say that's a great way to remember it. And we know that laning, you have to have a minyan anyways. So it got to be a minyan also.
Yeah,
and then the most opportune time to do that is a shul. So I'm saying,
how do you know I can't just sit at home with my chumash and fulfill the mitzvah the same way? Yeah, so this was so there's a lot that's discussed about this. Sorry? So is it on the seaboard? So is it seaboard or seaboard? Because they're both things, right? Both questions are worth asking. So first, the Gemara does say in Megillah and Daf Yud Ches that it's not just behear her. You would have thought maybe that it's just about remembering. And therefore, if I just think about it, it should be enough. I remembered. So the Gemara says, Yachol Belev, you could have thought that it's enough just to think about Amalek and you're in fulfillment. So know that the Torah also reinforces it with Lo Sishkach. By adding Lo Sishkach, that also tells you that it has to be bepeh. So the Gemara says that much, that it has to be out loud. Okay, so it has to be out loud. How do we know that it needs a minyan? So this is interesting just in terms of the development of halacha. So Rishonim say that it needs a minyan, but they almost all, it's derech agav, something else. So it's interesting, if these other discussions hadn't come up, how would we know that anyone says it needs a minyan? That's an interesting question just in terms of the development of halacha. So because other issues prompt the discussion, so you find it in a handful of Rishonim. Where do you find it? So it's debatably found in a rush in the Seventh Parak of Brachos. There's a whole discussion that the Gemara says that Rabbi Lazar was Meshachar and Eved because he had to do a big mitzvah. So what's the mitzvah? So it's not clear. Apparently he needed a minyan for something. So what is a big mitzvah that requires a minyan? So, sorry? I didn't hear you.
Gvura.
Oh, so that's an interesting suggestion. That's not what the Rush says. He says that he suggests that it's Zohar. There's a lot of discussion if that's what he meant, a lot of discussion if that's actually the correct Girsa, if that's actually the correct reading. But many quote this Rush, many argue on the reading of this Rush, many quote this Rush, interpreting that Gemara as saying that you need a minyan min HaTorah for Zohar. So that's one possible source that says like this. There's also a Truma Sadeshin. The Truma Sadeshin has a discussion to address the question. So let's say somebody were to say, I live in a town where we don't normally have a minyan. And I'm going to go to a town that has a minyan for Purim so I can hear the Megillah. So once I'm doing that, should I maybe already go from the previous Shabbos so I could hear Zohar? To which the Truma Sadeshin writes, yes, and not only that, but it's more important to go for Shabbos than it is for Purim, because Megillah does not require a minyan. You can read Megillah without a minyan, bismana. But Zohar, that you need to be there for a minyan, so therefore that's kedai to go for that purpose even more than for the Megillah. So you have sources like that mention minyan for a zachar. There's also, in terms of the Kriyas HaTorah, there's a Tosfos in two places. Tosfos in the second parak of Brachas, Tosfos also in Megillah, that discusses the fact that the Gemara has a discussion interpreting Psukim to address the question of whether Torah b'chalashen nemra or b'lashen hakodesh nemra. Does Torah have to be specifically b'lashen hakodesh, or could it be in any language? So Tosfos discusses, well, what's nafkamina? What do we mean if it has to be b'lashen hakodesh or not? We're talking about learning. So learning has to be b'lashen hakodesh. We know it's not true. No one ever said that you can't give shir in other languages. So you can't talk about Torah in other languages. So it's not true that learning has to be b'lashen hakodesh. And it can't be talking about Kriya Shema either, because the Gemara contrasts. The Gemara has the Limudin from Sukkim that Kriya Shema is one din and the rest of the Torah is another din. So this is not talking about Kriya Shema, and it doesn't seem like it's talking about Talmud Torah. So what is it talking about? So it doesn't seem like it's talking about Kriya HaTorah either, because Kriya HaTorah, we assume, is generally a din derabanan. So Sukkim are not going to be addressing Kriya HaTorah, because that's a later innovation. So what are the Pesukim talking about? If the Pesukim are trying to tell us Divrei Torah, B'lashon HaKodesh Nemra, or otherwise, what's it talking about? If it's not talking about learning, it's not talking about laning, it's not talking about Kriya Shema, so what is it talking about? So Tosa suggests that there are some things that do have a biblical obligation to be read, and that's what the context could be. So among them, it mentions a zacher. So it could be, this is another source that you need to have a minyan and a kriya for Parsha Zacher. So you have a couple of Rishonim that seem to say like that, and you have others who don't say like that. The Rambam, the Mishneh Torah, is clear, Ramban as well, that all the Dalet Parshiyos are on the same level. All the Dalet Parshiyos are the Rabbanan, and Zachar is not different from the rest of them. So there's a discussion in the Rishonim if the laning of Parsha Zachar is indeed a Daraisa together with the Minyan. The general understanding then is that it would be different in its nature from both Kriyas HaTorah, not just in terms of Daraisa and Rabbanan, but also in terms of how the mitzvah is structured, that it would be different in its nature both from Kriyas HaTorah at a regular Shabbos and from Kriyas HaMegillah. Because Kriyas HaMegillah, as we said a minute ago, doesn't require a minyan. So Kriyas HaTorah is a chovas hayachid. It's an obligation on the individual. We want to have a minyan because, first of all, as the Shulchan Aruch says, Barovam Hadras Melech, it's better to do it with a minyan, but it's not necessary. We read Megillah without a minyan a lot for people who are in hospitals or can't come to shul. It doesn't require a minyan, it's just ideal to have a minyan. We also do it usually in a group because Barovam, but also it's easier because not everyone's capable of reading the Megillah, so we want to have everyone able to listen to somebody, so we have group readings. But theoretically, we don't have to have a minyan. So Megillah is the Chovas HaYochid. Kriyas HaTorah is a discussion whether Kriyas HaTorah is a Chovas HaYochid or a Chovas HaTzibur. So most understand, Reb Chaim Brisker understood differently, but most understand that Kriyas HaTorah, based on a Ramban, is a Chovas HaTzibur, that it's an obligation that's on a community to lay, and it's the right thing to do to be a part of what the community is doing. But it's not a personal obligation. So if somebody misses Kriyas HaTorah, we don't have an obligation on a personal level to make it up. If the whole seaboard misses Kriyas HaTorah, it's a different story. If there's a snowstorm or something like that, and the shul just doesn't convene, so then that's a different discussion. But if the shul lanes and the individuals miss it, we don't obligate those individuals to make up Kriyas HaTorah. Reb Chaim understood differently, or Soloveitchik had a different practice. As Reb Schechter often relates, that in the early days, the Rav used to travel from Boston on a Monday, and he would miss Kriyas HaTorah in the morning. So when he got here in the afternoon, he would somehow magically find 10 guys, 9 other guys who didn't hear Kriyas HaTorah that day, and he would have the Kriyas HaTorah in the afternoon to make up for the Kriyas HaTorah that was missed that morning, and that people who walked past would do a double take. They thought it was a timeless, why is he leaning in the afternoon? But that was his assumption, that it's a chovas hayachid. But most poskim assume that it is a chovas hatzibur, so it's not a personal responsibility, it's an obligation on the community. Question about that? That's what it sounds like. Again, you know, this is all a little bit the assumption that there is such a chiyuv. So we can get into details more if we fully understood exactly how that would play out. So it comes out then that Zachar is a third model. That Zachar, if it requires a minion, Zachar is a chovas hayachid that is fulfilled with tzibur. So you need a tzibur to do it, even though it's a personal obligation. So it's three models. Megillah is a chovas hayachid, doesn't really need the minion. Kriyas HaTorah is all about the minion, is a chovas hatzibur. And Zachar is a chovas hayachid that takes place with tzibur. So based on something like that, Reb Chaim suggested that Zachar should be done a little differently than Kriyas HaTorah normally, so that even when somebody gets an aliyah for Parsha Zachar, so normally a person who is Ola is supposed to read along with the Bal Koreh, and we don't rely on Shemei Ka'ona for that. It's a discussion why not, and if that's absolutely true, but that's the general attitude. It says, but here, when you get the aliyah for Zachar, so you Davkar are supposed to be hearing it from the Bal Koreh B'tzibur, so therefore you should not read along with him, you should just listen to him. I asked Reshecht about this recently after many years of assuming this was the case. He told me that he didn't think this was a necessary practice to follow, but that was the way Reb Chaim understood it. So in any event, so that's how we assume nowadays that we work off this position that there is a chiyuv, presumably min HaTorah, to hear the parsha of Zachar from a Sefer Torah, presumably from a Kasher Sefer Torah, even though there were those who raised the possibility maybe it didn't have to be a Kasher Sefer Torah, but the others very much disagreed with that. And so we assume it has to be with the Kriyas Torah and with a minion. There are those who suggest that maybe this could part of the Sefer Torah could be traced back to the Pasuk in Parshas B'Shalach, which we read also as part of our Shvi this year. We saw this. So Zos Zikaron B'Sefer, that the Zikaron should be B'Sefer. So maybe that's why he is Sefer. And the idea of a minion, maybe that's supposed to correlate to the fact that the war on Amalek is not about the individual, it's about the tzibur. And therefore, it's a concept which should be performed by tzibur. So the remembrance should be done by tzibur because the notion is for the tzibur rather than for the individual. So what we still haven't addressed is, okay, so fine, I should hear Kriyas HaTorah and I should hear it with a minion. But I've done that once, so do I ever have to do it again? How do you know you have to do it every year? Where does that come from? So here there's a notion attributed to the Chassam Sofer, mostly through his well-known student, the Maramshik, that there's a concept called a Shir Shikcha, that there's an amount of time after which you can assume that people will start to forget things. And since the Torah says, Lo Sishkov, you should not forget, so you have to make sure to remind yourself before you forget. So how long does it take to forget things? The assumption is 12 months. So therefore, every year, we should have a reinforcement of Parsha Zachar in order to make sure we don't forget. Where does it get the idea of 12 months? So it's really based on two Gemaras. One is a Gemara in Maseches Brachos that says, Ein hames mishtakech min alev, ela achar yud beis chodesh, that a person who passed away, we don't start to forget him until after 12 months. And also is the Gemara in Second Parak above Metziah that talks about Yeish, about when you give up hope in getting your property that you lost, getting it back. So there we have a din, Stam Yeish Yud Beis Chodesh, that 12 months is when we assume there's been Yeish, so that seems to be the measurement. Jed?
What about the fact that we read the Parsha every year with the regular cycle?
So it's a good point, so let's come back to that, because that may be a saving element, we'll see in a second. But in any event, so this is where this idea of Yud Beis Chodesh comes from. So that concept of doing it once every year is interesting because First of all, you could say, wait a minute, we don't always make it. First of all, Shabbos falls out on different days of the month, so maybe it'll be just over 12 months. But more egregiously, what about a leap year? So every couple years, we throw in an extra month at the worst possible time, right before our next reading of Zohar. So doesn't the leap year mess up our 12-month cycle? So this was discussed also by the Ma'am Sheik, and there are various suggestions what to do about it. So Saab, as Jai was just asking, what about the fact that we, in our current schedule, so we do read from Parshas Kisetze every year anyway. It wasn't always the case. At the time of the Gemara, they didn't always have a yearly schedule, but nowadays we know that we'll cover Parshas Kisetze once a year anyway. So that's what some poskim suggest, that when the next year is going to be a leap year, when the next year there's going to be an extra Adar, that in the previous summer you should have in mind during Kisetze to be Yotze, so that you don't have 12 months elapse, otherwise you're going to be in trouble according to this idea. And there's a discussion, or Rav Sipesa Frank has a truth about this. Is it necessary for the Balkore to be aware of this? Does it require Kavana Lahotzi? Is it enough that you as a listener in Shul is aware of this? Does that require Kavana from both parties? There's a discussion. Hi.
What about an Avel, when there's a leap year? When is the 12 months over?
So that's a whole discussion.
Right,
so yeah, 12 regular months.
Yeah.
But yard site's an interesting discussion.
Right. So would that correlate?
Not necessarily.
Even though we compared it to 12 months?
I'll discuss that right now in a different context. But whether this is really a problem is an interesting question. I remember like my first year in college here, Rabbi Willig was an Avelis for his mother that year. And that June's mind used to be a different thing than it is now. So it used to be that they had June's mind, the whole yeshiva was learning the same thing. It was learning a parak from the Masechta that they hadn't been doing during the year. And every day of June's mind, they would have a shir kuali, that a different Rosh Yeshiva every day would say a shir in the base medrash on that parak. So my first year in college here, we were learning about Metziah. So June's month, they were learning the second parak about Metziah. So Rabbi Willig was in Avelis that year. So he talked about this concept of the Shir Shikha in that Gemara, in his Shir, the base medrash, if I remember correctly, I'm pretty sure. And he mentioned this Chassam Sofer, that and this concern based on the Chassam Sofer, it's not clear with the Chassam Sofer himself, actually says this, and the Sfarim and the students, the Ma'am Sheik, they bring this, but some room to wonder whether Chassam Sofer would agree with this concern himself. But as we will maintain then, that it doesn't mean specifically 12 months exactly. It means the yearly cycle, the idea, you know, something happens on Hanukkah, so then the next year Hanukkah, you reset. After when two Hanukkahs pass, you're ready now in a different mindset. So when you hit the same point next year, so then you start to forget about the previous things. But it's not that it's exactly 12 months, and if your year is 13 months long, that you're not going to remember anymore. It's that they say yearly cycle. It's about that. It's not about 12 months specifically. But the whole concept of the Shir Shikha is also debated. The Satmar Rav and others question this, because they don't necessarily buy either proof. So the idea of Stam Yeish is Yud Beis Chodesh. So Yeish doesn't mean forgetting. Yeish means that you give up hope of getting your property back. So it doesn't mean that you forgot about it. So we don't know from there, Eishir Shekha. And the idea of Eina Meis Mishtakech Min Alev, this idea of forgetting about a mace after 12 months, that means that when you're working on getting over it, you're working on getting past the grief, so after 12 months it starts to work. It doesn't necessarily connote that when there's a mitzvah to remember something, that you're going to start forgetting it after a year. Maybe that won't happen. So they don't necessarily sign on to this idea. And the assumption is that the reading of Zohar on the yearly cycle is something that Chazal associated with Purim. That clearly there's a thematic connection between Zohar and Purim. And therefore, Chazal ordained that we would have the Kriya of Parsha Zohar every year before Purim. But it doesn't necessarily reflect that the Chi of Daraisa would require you to do it with that frequency. It doesn't give us an absolute answer of what the frequency is. But it doesn't necessarily have to emerge from that idea. So I certainly recommend very strongly everyone be in Shul the Shabbos to hear Parshas Zachar with the Minyan. But we have to figure out the different parts of how that necessarily becomes a full-blown mitzvah mina Torah. And is that an obligation for women? So that's something we spoke about a little bit on Sunday, a week or two ago, how that could possibly affect the chiyuv of Megillah. So there is a discussion whether women are chayavos. Pashup shah, one would think they should be, because it's not a mitzvah seishas one grama. So, and that's part of what we just established now. The Torah says, remember a malik, but does not, clearly, everyone agrees that does not say you have to do it on this Shabbos specifically, or just at any time specifically. So it's very difficult, based on what we've just noted, to call it a mitzvah saseh shazman grama. So why should women be pturis? It's not clear. And many did not accept this, brought in the name of Rav Nassan Adler, who was the Rebbe of the Chassam Sofer, that he was very makbid on all the women in his household to make sure that they heard Parsha Zachar. But those who assume that women are pturos, so it's based on a Sefer Achinuch that makes the statement. When Sefer Achinuch, if you know his style, so at the end of describing a mitzvah, he always tells you who's obligated and who's not. So here he says women are pturos, and you have to figure out exactly why that is. It's commonly explained, like the Mechashas, that it's because, again, this is a mitzvah on the tzibur. It's a mitzvah to remember so that we can fight Amalek, and the Melchemes Amalek is a vital part of the whole thing. So assuming that women don't go out to fight against the Amalek, so therefore maybe that could be why they would be pturis.
Is that as a fair assumption?
Sorry?
Is that a fair assumption?
No, it's a debatable assumption. We mentioned that last time, we spoke about this 2 or 3 weeks ago, that it's a... There's a Mishnah in Sota that says that for a Melchemes Mitzvah, like a Malek, so everyone goes out, afilu kala mechupaso. So even the bride goes out from her chuppah in order to participate in the Melchemes Mitzvah, so it's not so obvious. This was a big discussion back and forth, various so far considering the weight of this. So there are adiyom hazad, different attitudes about whether women are chayavos or not. It's also a discussion in Poskim to relate, I guess Zach, you mentioned something about this, about what's the best way to do it. So our practice is to read the Tzivui and to read God's declaration, to read the commandment about Zechiras HaMalek from the end of Kiseitze. There is some discussion, what about Parshas Beshalach that we read again in our Chumash here, we did that 7th Aliyah a few weeks ago. So that's the Kriyas HaTorah on Purim. It's the shortest Kriyas HaTorah ever, because normally we require at least 10 psukim, but here we do it because it's an Indian shalom, so it's 9 psukim long. So Vayavo Amalek, so it was a discussion whether you could be Yotzei Amalek with that, or with, does it have to be specifically with Kiseitze, Mishnevur, Slavetchik? There are various opinions about that. It's a whole discussion what exactly is the theme of the mitzvah. So what section of the Torah does that require us to remember? So you could perhaps suggest al pi derech hadrush, really a little bit of a package idea here. We assume most commonly that there are 6 mitzvos of Zechira. That is also an arguable assumption. There are those who disagree. There are those who don't count all the ones that we count, and there are those who count more than we count. There, Levi Yitzchak Berditchev has in a Sefer Kedushas Levi a section on the 6 Zechiros, but it's not the same 6 that we have. He also has remembering Eretz Yisrael, remembering the Man. So there's some debate as to what is counted as a mitzvah of Zechira or not. So it ranges, if you add up all the ones that are thrown into the mix, it's somewhere between 4 and 9. But what's most commonly considered to be mitzvahs of Zechira, what are they? The mitzvah of Zechiras Shabbos, Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim, Zechiras Maimon Har Sinai, and Zechiras Egel HaZav, assuming that's what the Pasuk is talking about, and Zechiras Amalek, and Zechiras Miriam. All right, so that makes 6. So again, not everyone agrees, but we'll work off the assumption that that's the set, those six. So it's an interesting question, Bechlal. So if they're all phrased in similar ways in the Torah, not exactly, but in similar ways in the Torah, so why is our practice different regarding all of them? Almost no two are done the same way. We say, Zachar Asom HaShabbos, that primarily means make Kiddush. Zachar Asom Malik, that means laying Parsha Zachar. We don't really have common fulfillments here in Zechiras Mitzrayim. That is a recitation we do twice a day. So what exactly is the common element in practice here? So that's a good question. Why, if they're similar mitzvahs, why don't they have similar fulfillments? And that, some suggest that this is a concept of Masur HaKasav L'Chachamim, that Chazal were given the authority to decide how these mitzvahs d'oraisa would be best accomplished in each case. What would be the best form in order to fulfill these things? But still, the question always comes up, why exactly do we have these six? There's a lot of important things in the Torah. The whole Torah is important. And we have a general prohibition of shikchas haTorah. We're not supposed to forget the content of the Torah. So there's a mitzvah zechira by everything. What does it mean to remember these six as distinct from the rest of the Torah? So it seems like these six together perhaps create a message that is just crucial for understanding a philosophy of Judaism, that there is a basic bare-bones philosophy of Judaism that emerges from these six. And perhaps you could say as follows, that first and foremost, what's the most important thing to know is a God who created the world. Right? So that's what Zechiras HaShabbos is there to remind us, that God exists and He created the world. So we have to remember Shabbos. So, okay, that's a good first step. But then one might say, okay, I believe God created the world, but like some of the founding fathers of America, they were deists. So you can take a deist approach and say, yes, God exists and He put us here, but He ceases to care about history after that. He set the world in motion, but there's no involvement in human history. So Yetzias Mitzrayim is meant to emphasize that aspect, that not only did God create the world, but He continues to be actively involved in human history, and Yetzias Mitzrayim discusses that most blatantly. So okay, so that's the next step. So then you could say, all right, so fine, there's a God, He created the world, and He's involved in history, but He doesn't care what we do. So we don't have any personal responsibilities as a function of that. So therefore, we have to remember, no, it's Maimon Har Sinai, that yes, we very much have responsibilities together with that. And that's what remembering Matan Torah is about, to remind us of such obligations. So then we could say, all right, if that's the case, so then we're all about these obligations. And if we forget, and if we stumble, and if we fall, so there's no going back, because our whole existence is defined by these obligations. So that's why we're told to remember the Egel Azav. That's the theme of tshuva. That's to remember that even if we stumble, it's possible to come back. And therefore, that's also a crucial part. So that gives us four principles of Jewish belief. God created the world. He continues to be involved in human history. He gave us a mission for us to perform. And if we stumble in that mission, it's still possible to come back. The principle of tshuva. So that leaves Amalek and Miriam. So, what is the relationship between Amalek and Miriam? So, one could say that they are... Sorry? Yes, well, we mentioned before, but I'll say a different... I'm building on that, but I'll say a different connection. So, Miriam and Amalek could represent polar opposites. That, essentially, one could take a morally relativistic attitude to the world and say there's no such thing as good and bad, there's just good and less good, good and differently good. There is no real good and bad in the world. And that's a big mistake. That's a big problem. So these two halachos of Lashon Hara and Amalek, in a sense, represent that there is good and bad in the world, and that has to be understood and appreciated and used as a metric for the rest of things, the rest of existence. And Lashon Hara represents this in one sense, because one might say, alright, why is there an Isser of Lashon Hara? What's so terrible? Why can't I say, if I'm saying things that are true, what's wrong with saying it? What's the problem in relating things that are factual? So to that, the response could be, if we consider Lashon Hara, and we consider the prohibition of speaking badly about Eretz Yisrael, where there's a similar concept, that yes, what you're saying is true, but if you really had a full appreciation for who this other person is, or especially who Eretz Yisrael is, so then these bad things, they wouldn't make your radar screen. They wouldn't be something that you would find necessary to discuss. So the fact that you're able to complain about what you're complaining about, so that's a lack of full appreciation for the godless of another person and for the godless of Eretz Yisrael, and that's why it's an aveira, perhaps. So therefore, one of the messages of Lashon Hara is that there are some things that are so good that it doesn't matter the bad that's mixed in. The fact that there's bad, it shouldn't be something that you take notice of, because the good should dominate, and that should be the main point of focus. While Amalek is the opposite. Amalek is to make the point that there is evil in the world, and some things are evil and are not redeemable inherently. And therefore, we should recognize that they have the obligation of Mechias Amalek, Amalek representing the evil, not even representing the people necessarily, because the whole discussion, you could theoretically maybe be Makabel Gerim for Amalek. But Amalek, as a concept, Amalek represents evil, and you can't put a good spin on that. Again, just to clarify, it could be that the people who are Amalek, that they may be redeemable. But the concept of Amalek, as is, without changing, cannot be put in a positive light, and Amalek is inherently evil. So if that's the case, so then the message is that just as one side represents the good, this represents the bad. And we should know that it's not something that can be kosher. It's not something that can be improved. And therefore, perhaps, that could also explain the idea that we have the practice, as we mentioned at the outset, of doing this B'kriyas HaTorah and doing this B'tzibur, that two things that tend to paper over problems, two things that tend to allow something to rise to the top, even if it's problematic, if the Torah is metahir and the tzibur is metahir, as we've spoken about, that the achdus of Klal Yisrael is able to override deficiencies. So even within the context of these two things, the Torah and the tzibur, so Amalek is still Amalek, and that's perhaps the message of the concept of Mechias Amalek. So therefore, these two points, Miriam and Amalek, represent these two axioms. These two axes, rather, that's a better term, axes, that there is bad and good, and it's not simply that everything is just on a sliding scale. These are the two extremes. So then, just to recap, these six zechiras perhaps represent these six points of Jewish philosophy. God created the world. He continues to be involved in human history. He has expectations of us. But if we stumble from those expectations, it's possible to do tshuva. And there is good and bad in the world. And those have to be recognized, even as everything else is assessed between those points. All right, so we will stop there. We wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. And Sunday, we'll fill in as much as we can about the season of topics.